So I'll read now from the Parinibbana Sutta. And the Buddha says, "You should live as islands unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a person live as an island unto himself, as with no other refuge? Here a person abides, contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put away all hankering and fretting for the world. And likewise, with regard to feelings, mind, and mind objects. That is how a person lives, as an island unto oneself, as one's own refuge, taking the Dhamma as a refuge, with no other refuge but the Dhamma." And having talked and discussed a little bit the refuge, it's quite a strong statement right near the end of the Buddha's life, where he says, "Take no other refuge but yourself, take no other refuge but the Dhamma." And since those statements, you know, would have to be logically be the same, otherwise they contradict each other, there's some way of understanding the Dhamma and Dharma and oneself as being the same. And this, when you come forward up in the front, Pesha, you can hear, and we can be more intimate. There's some way of understanding the word Dharma, Dhamma in Pali, and oneself, one's true self, one's real self, as being perhaps the same. So the Buddha says, take oneself as one's own refuge. Take the Dhamma as a refuge. And then he explains how to do that, actually. And what's very interesting for us, since we practice the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, he then goes on, says, you practice the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness is the way that you take refuge in the self, the way you take refuge in the Dharma. And so, you know, we talked in the class about how each of us would have their own understanding of what it means to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And then this ceremony we'll do tonight is really a place where each of us can hopefully feel really acknowledged in what's already true for each of you. That there's some commitment, some intent that brings you to practice, it brings you to the Sangha, that is quite, I think, quite strong. And so you're inspired to come to a ceremony like this. Most of you came to the classes. So this is already a chance to acknowledge what's already here. And to think, what does it mean to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha? And this ceremony, normally, in Southeast Asia, would happen on either the full moon or the new moon. Probably on the full moon, like we have here. Those two, the full moon, the new moon, and often the quarter moons in between, are the holy days for in Theravadan Buddhism. And that's a day that the lay people would most frequently come to a temple to make offerings, to meditate, to practice, and to take take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and to receive the precepts from the monks, and then try to live by those precepts during those days. So here we are, it's a full moon, and the last full moon that we had a celebration was the Buddha's birthday, enlightenment, and his passing away day a month ago. So this is kind of like we've been studying the precepts and a little bit, and the refuges in between. And the moon, as I think many of you know, is symbolic in Buddhism for enlightenment, or for the fullness, for the wholeness of life that can be experienced through one's own realization. The luminous quality of the moon is sometimes likened to the luminous quality of the mind that is free and pure. And I was thinking about this, you know, the moon, the full moon, which maybe we'll see tonight, depending. Oh, I see it. We'll see. You wait, you'll wait. Just wait a few more minutes. Ah, perfect. So, and so the moon is full. And then sometimes we say the moon is new, or we say the moon is quarter full, or whatever we say. And the whole idea where the moon is new or old, or full or empty, or whatever, all these words, the moon couldn't care less. The identity that we have attribute to the moon has nothing to do with what the moon actually is, but rather its particular vantage point, perspective we have on the moon in relationship to the sun and all, that we see the moon in a certain way, and then we say, well, that moon is full, that moon is empty, or that moon is new, or that moon is full. But actually, it has nothing to do with the nature of the moon. The moon couldn't care less what the people down here on the earth are saying about it. And it's particularly not anxious that we think that it's one way or the other. And I think to take refuge in the self, take refuge in the Dharma, is to perhaps take refuge in some aspect of ourselves which is like that aspect of the moon, which is unfazed by the normal kinds of identities that many people get caught up in. And we try to defend, we try to assert on the world, we try to... that gets demolished, gets criticized, gets, all these terrible things that happen around this notion of self. And is there some aspect of self which is unfazed by the names that we call it, by the identities we assume on it? Is there some aspect of Dharma, of reality as it is, which has nothing to do with sufficiency or insufficiency or adequacy or inadequacy, or with the kind of normal polarities that many of our lives swing back and forth between? So I believe to take refuge in Dharma, take refuge in what can be called maybe the true self, I think we have to say the true self, when the Buddha says take refuge in the self, he doesn't mean the small sense of self, the egotistical sense of self, that is many of the places where a lot of suffering arises, but rather he's talking about taking refuge in some sense of self, some true sense of self, some profounder sense. And there is this expression of forgetting the self, forgetting oneself. And Zen Master Dogen has that famous quote, which I like so much. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be awakened by all things. But we have this expression in English, to forget oneself. But I think to forget oneself happens a lot in our life, where we simply forget that we're operating on some egotistical sense of self. And we're just going along full speed ahead with our pride or insecurity or whatever, and we've forgotten ourselves in the midst of being insecure or being full of pride. And I don't think that's what's being talked about. Rather, it's the disappearance of self, disappearance of that small self, which is a possibility when we're engaged fully with our life, when we sit quietly and let our mind be unencumbered by the normal proliferation of concepts and ideas about who we are, as opposed to actually letting who we are express itself and come bubble up through us, rather than overlaying some ideas of who we are. But to allow it to bubble up through us is often a frightening thing, because it represents the unknown. It has to represent the unknown. To really allow yourself to be yourself is to enter into an unknown territory, because who knows? If you're not having concepts or ideas to hold things in neat categories, and you're allowing the deeper sense of self to arise with the self forgotten, the surface self forgotten, one has to be quite willing, in a sense kind of courageous, to let go of control, to let go of defense, to let go of fixed ideas, and to allow the inner expression to come out. It's very easy to set up the idea of the disappearance of self to being a passive state where the mind is kind of empty of concepts and ideas. And I think that's often a place where we first get a sense of what, of a new possibility of existing in the world. It's from the sense of meditation, of letting a normal kind of neurotic sense of self settle down and disappear, and feel a sense of well-being that can come that isn't part of the normal polarities that so much confuse us in our lives. But if it's only passive, if it's only in meditation, it's only half the work. And the other half, I think, of practice is to allow that deeper sense of self to express itself in our life, in the life around us. And not to allow the moon to be something off in the distant, but allow the moon to exist in our very activities themselves. So to take refuge in all this, to take refuge in what I hope is this deep interconnectedness to something that's much more enduring than any of the changing ideas of who we might be. They talk a lot in Buddhism about the deathless. The deathless is the only thing which is maybe reliable enough for any kind of security. To take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. I think many of us know that the normal refuges that people in our culture take as supports to rely on are notoriously unreliable. A lot of people put their refuge in their bank account, or in their jobs, or in their relationships, or in their health, or in, you know, whatever. Things that are very changeable. And the great, there was some of us, I don't know if anybody here, but there was a Yucca Valley retreat, a 20-day retreat down in the desert some years ago. And people were sitting very quietly meditating for all these days. And I think it was during the Dharma talk, there was this massive earthquake. And people came back and reported that what they usually took quite for granted, something was quite reliable. The solidity of the earth simply, you know, was unreliable during that earthquake. Or my experience in Burma of finding, I kind of think that money is like pretty reliable stuff. You know, I grew up thinking that the green dollar bill was like, that was, you can always depend on it. You know, value might decrease a little bit over the years, but basically, you know, it was reliable stuff. So when I went to Burma, I kind of figured it was the same thing, that the money was reliable. It's like, that was pretty much given. And so there I converted a lot of my American dollars into Burmese money, and then retreated to the monastery to meditate. And in the middle of my retreat there, after about 4 months, the government decided that all the money that I had was from one day to the next was worthless. It wasn't worth anything. So I was rather surprised. You know, I thought money kind of was money, you know. And how could, you know, I wake up one morning and find out that this was just, now is worth as much as toilet paper. It was rather of a shock to me. So where do we usually put our trust? What do we really rely on? And what can we rely on? And one of the things that I've learned that we can rely on, that we can really take refuge in, is in practice itself. That the mindfulness practice, that is one of the more enduring refuges we can take. And because the mindfulness practice teaches us that the way in which we respond or react to the world fits into our choice, the world of our choice. And it's not obvious always when we first start practicing that we're acting out of choice. But our response to the conditions around us has to do with our choice. Whether we hate something or whether we desire something belongs to the world of choice and intention. And as we begin seeing this, and as the normal holds of the mind begin softening a little bit, and you see an alternative way of being, what practice teaches us is that at least we can rely on practice that our response to a situation will not get us into deeper trouble. That our response to a situation will not be a tightening up of the mind or the heart, or that creates increasing suffering. Even though what happens around us might be very difficult and painful. And who knows what happens around us? Who knows if they, you know, you wake up tomorrow and all your dollar bills disappear, or the banks burn down, or an earthquake, or you get sick. I mean, who knows? All these things might change. But if you bring your practice to all those changing things, then you bring the possibility of at least you and your response to that situation can remain balanced and open. You can still remain open regardless of what happens to you. And that's the offering of what practice offers. And that's a kind of a refuge, to know that at least you don't have to add to the situation by the way in which you react and respond. So for me, I take refuge in that. And that's a very important source of refuge for me. And when I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, in part I'm taking refuge in my ability to practice and my trust in the practice. There are many situations I find myself in where I simply don't know what the right answer is, how to respond. But I feel I can always trust the practice, the process of mindfulness, of noticing my reactions and responses, and learning somehow to maintain some freedom and perspective in the midst of all the difficulties, regardless of what's happening. So there are three different areas of taking refuge, which I talked about the first class. And one of them is there's the intentional aspect, that this is a choice that we make, that we want to intend our life, incline our life in a certain direction. We want to orient our life in a certain direction. And this is, so you come here tonight with an intention. You've hopefully reflected a little bit on what it means for you to take refuge, and it's something you'd like to do. And it represents some intention to practice, some intention of involvement with, for whatever Buddha, Dharma, Sangha means for you, there's an intention. The second understanding of refuge is it has to do with an understanding, a knowledge. And sometimes that's clearer than other times. An understanding of maybe what the potential is of freedom, the potential of an awakened mind, of an open mind. And some of you have touched that, and some of you have smelled it, and some of you have seen shadows of it. But we all know it in some way. And the third is there's a emotional or devotional aspect of taking refuge. And that'll vary among different people, the strength of the emotional aspect. But there can well up within us a tremendous amount of faith and reverence, gratitude and love for the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, for the practice, for our own hearts as they open up, for our own minds as they become more open and free, and for the Sangha and the community of people that we share this wonderful practice with. We share this freedom and movement towards freedom, towards kindness, towards compassion. I can't see the candles over there. Are they okay? And the last thing I wanted to say about refuge is that normally we say we take refuge, or we go for refuge. It's something intentional and we do. But I believe that there's no going for refuge, taking refuge, without simultaneously offering refuge to others. That the two go hand in hand. And that as we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I hope that what we have in mind also is that we then become a field, an offering. We become an intention to also help support other people in their own negotiation, their own way of finding, their own deep sense of self, their own deep expressivity, their own deep freedom and potential of what's within them. And it doesn't mean making anybody a Buddhist. It means helping people find out who they really are in the context of who they are. Rather than making them look like they're Buddhist. But to offer refuge, to offer a place where people feel safe to be themselves, is, I think, one of the things it means to also to take refuge. So I hope that you consider that also as you embark and engage on this ceremony. I think the three treasures, or the three jewels, which is what we take refuge in, is also a cave, or a room, or a cavern, or that we enter into to explore. and to discover what actually are these things. And I think it becomes a lifelong exploration within this great cavern, this great container of practice. And I like somewhat that, I don't know where I got this idea, but that the idea of being open, to be open-hearted, open-minded, to be free, is very closely related in my mind to the notion of being interested. To be open-minded also means, I think, to me, to be interested in what's going on. And questioning, interested and questioning what's happening. And I think that as we go into the refuge, as we go into a life of practice, that we take, that it's a life of interest in the world around us and in ourselves. And a life of questioning, of deep questioning. That not taking things for granted, not taking Buddhism for granted, not taking any religious discipline for granted, not taking any teacher for granted, but rather it's a life where we go in and question deeply what is being said, what is the situation here, and who am I in this context, what do I bring to it. It's a life of questioning, of a life of perhaps of seeking, in a sense, questioning interest, seeking interest, with the understanding that, and what's said in many different traditions, is that often what we are seeking in a deep spiritual life is that which seeks. That the impetus to seek, to be interested, the impetus to question, the desire to be open, to be compassionate, to seek for some truth, that desire is the very thing that we're seeking. It's really a beautiful thing within us. That desire is part of this deep expressivity of the Dharma that moves through us, of the deep self. That which seeks itself, that which searches, that which inspired or has the intention to practice. So as we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, I hope that some of you think of it as also taking refuge in that movement to practice, the inspiration and intention to practice, that you find some protection and refuge in it. So what I have here for you all is a little statement or document that I've written for each of you to receive. And part of it is a kind of, you'll see when you look at it, but it's kind of it looks like a leaf, the drawing, but it's actually kind of like a mandala. And it's to recognize that each of us exists in a mandala of interconnected practitioners. That each of us is not alone in practicing, but rather our ability to practice, our inspiration to practice, our coming to practice and even know the possibility to practice, the support we have to continue our practice, exists because we live within a nexus, within a mandala of interconnected relationships of other practitioners. And so taking refuge tonight, I think I want you to think of this also as being acknowledgement of this interconnected mandala of support that we receive and that we offer to others around us. And it's a mandala of support of interconnectedness that goes back 2,500 years to the time of the Buddha, where numerous, uncountable people have practiced before us. And only because of their practice have we been able to come here, gather tonight, to celebrate, in a sense, each of our own engagement with the world of practice. And it was brought up last Wednesday that the idea that some of the lineages that go back historically to the Buddha are predominantly male lineages. But as I read the history of Buddhism and kind of dig a little bit deeper beyond kind of the surface textbook introduction to Buddhism, you find that many examples of quite inspiring women who were essential for this continuation of the practice. And that I don't think of this as being a male-dominated tradition, though it often looks like that. And we have up here, you know, on the altar, we have the Buddha as an example of someone who has attained enlightenment and freedom and entered the world with great compassion. But the model that the Buddha gives of his life is a model which many of us in the West question, you know, how good of a model is that for us? A man whose wife had just given birth to his only son, and seeing the situation and feeling there was a hindrance, his married life, his family life, he saw it as such a hindrance, and the name that he gave to his son, Rahula, means in Sanskrit, obstacle. So, and then he renounced, he left his family, and went off then and wandered around India for, six, 7 years before he came back to offer anything in return. And there's a lot to be said about that, and I'm not going to be critical of it, but there are people who wonder, well, that's not a particularly good model for me. Here I am, a lay person in the West practicing, and here's this person who renounced lay life in the family, and maybe this is not a particularly good model for me. I don't want to go off and be an ascetic for 6 years. But another figure in the tradition that is as important, I feel, as the Buddha is the figure of the Buddha's foster mother, Mahaprajapati. Whereas the Buddha was the founder of the monk's order, Mahaprajapati was a founder of the nun's order. And you look at her life of practice and you find a very different role model for that in some ways is maybe more suitable for those of us practicing in the West as lay people. Mahaprajapati didn't renounce her family, but rather she raised the Buddha. She was a foster mother of the Buddha. The Buddha's mother died when he was 7 days old. And Mahaprajapati was his aunt, and she raised him. And she raised two other children of her own. And she was the wife of the king, and so she, you know, took care of the family. And then when the Buddha left, she continued to take care of her family responsibilities, her responsibilities that she had as the queen of this tribal republic in the Himalayas. And she was known as a very wise woman. And many people would come to her, and many of the women would come to her for advice. Maybe because she'd gone through a very rich, full household life, where a lot of, I think, wisdom she had learned a lot of wisdom just from the fact of living in the world itself. When her husband had died, which in India was a very difficult time, because when a woman was mostly someone in Indian society by being connected to a man, and if a husband dies, it's very difficult for an Indian woman to kind of feel a connection anymore. When her husband died, then she went to the Buddha and asked if she could also undertake the religious life. And here she was already quite aged, advanced in age. And the Buddha, in reply, didn't say, "No, I won't ordain you," which is sometimes what people think. What the Buddha said was a little bit different. He said, "That's enough. Please don't ask that question." He didn't say no. He said, "Please don't ask that question." And she asked three times, and three times he said, "Please don't ask that question." And a lot could be said about why maybe the Buddha was reluctant to take on that question, to respond to that question. And then the Buddha left where he was staying, and he wandered from 200-300 miles away. At which point Mahaprajapati, because she was a wise woman, was known for her wisdom, she gathered around her many other women who had lost their husbands or their family. I don't know why they gathered around her, but many other women gathered around her. And they marched those 200-300 miles to where the Buddha was with tremendous determination and seriousness, great intent. They weren't going to mess around. And showed up and asked again, could they please be ordained to enter the religious life, the monastic life? At which point Ananda, who was Buddha's attendant, intervened and carried the message of this request to the Buddha directly. And discussed this matter with the Buddha and asked, isn't it true that women can also have the possibility of becoming free and enlightened? And he said, of course. And Nanda said, well, why don't you give them a chance to practice the religious life, to become a monastic? And he said, well, okay. So he agreed. But what I think for me, the role model of Mahaprajapati, of this person who goes through a whole life as a layperson, engaged in the world, raising a family, becoming wise in that context, and from perhaps that wisdom, then entering into a religious life, in my mind at least, is a much more inspiring role model for us who are trying to be lay people in the West than the model of the Buddha, who attained the same enlightenment, but through a very different path. So I'm saying all this because the rich mandala, the rich pattern of interconnectedness that supports us here today in our practice today, is made up of many different models of people's practice, many different people who practice in many different ways. And we have the monastic model, strong monastic model of the Buddha, and we have in a sense the lay model of Mahaprajapati. And down through the ages it goes. And I feel very fortunate that in my own, in the time that I practiced Buddhism, both in the West and the East, it was a time when a lot of women were already becoming teachers. So I feel very fortunate that at the time that I began practicing Buddhism, there were in the Buddhist scenes, both here in the West and also in Asia, many women, not simply practitioners that I co-practiced with, but actually women teachers, women who were my teachers that I got to practice under, in a sense, or study with. And starting right here at the San Francisco Zen Center, there were already women who had been practicing there for many years, who then I studied with and I went and discussed my practice with and explored. When I went to Japan, one of the more impressive teachers that I had a chance to meet there and spend a little bit of time with was a Japanese woman Zen teacher. And then there was an American Zen teacher in Japan who was just bubbling heart of compassion. And I felt very fortunate to have been able to study in the same monastery with her. When I went to Asia, I didn't study directly under so many women, but I had the wonderful opportunity to encounter a number of women. I encountered Dipa Ma in Calcutta, that I've told you a little bit about. This wonderful old Indian woman, poor Indian woman who lived in tenements in the poor areas of Calcutta, and third floor of this tenement building and a small little apartment with a big family. And she's considered to be one of the people, most realized people, most enlightened people to come out of the tradition of meditation that IMS, the Spirit Rock teachers, teach. Very highly attained. And it was wonderful to meet her. And, you know, she gave me her blessing in a sense. I felt very lucky to have known her. And then when I was in Thailand also, I met a number of women teachers. I didn't really practice under them, but I had a chance to talk with them about practice and learn from their experience of their life of practice. So I say this to emphasize for all of us how rich it is, the interconnected mandala that we're all part of. That it not only includes Westerners, it includes Asians, includes Europeans, includes people in all parts of the world who are engaged in the practice of truth, of waking up. And the mandala, interconnected mandala, in a Buddhist ceremony, it's mostly we recognize the Buddhist friends that we have. But if, you know, the Dharma, people who really find the Dharma, take refuge in themselves, in a deep self, sense of self, they are found in all religious traditions. It's not something unique to Buddhism. And so as we practice and we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and take refuge in ourselves in a deep sense of self, the true sense of self, I believe that we also become sensitive to recognize the truth that's found in other people also. And our own sense of practice then resonates with the practice and awakening of these other people, even though the vocabulary can be quite different. So to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, for me, is not to simply take refuge in Buddhists and Buddhist terminology, Buddhist ideas and whatever, but to really take refuge in whatever it is, whoever it is, that seems to resonate with what's true, with awakening, with freedom. And to find inspiration from that meeting of other free people. One of the freest people I thought I ever met in my life, outside of the world of Buddhism for me, was a Sufi teacher I met in Turkey a few years ago. And it was, I felt so at home being with him. In a sense, I feel like I could take refuge in the Dharma, the Buddha, and the Sangha in that teacher also. So I'm speaking for myself now. So I don't know what it is. You know, I haven't heard from each of you what it really means for each of you. But I'm very happy to be here this evening with all of you, and to know that all of you come here with intention, with some sense of connectedness to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and that we share this in this wonderful mandala that we've created here tonight, a supportive mandala of fellow practitioners. And for those of you who are from Palo Alto, you know, I think it's quite phenomenal what has happened here in, over the last years in developing this interconnected, supportive group of friends who practice together and support each other and inspire each other. And I hope that each of you inspires all the rest of us. And I'm inspired by all of the people who come to our Sangha in Palo Alto. And I'm very grateful, extremely grateful, for the inspiration and the support that I feel I get from all of you. So it's gotten dark. I was hoping, part of this, I was hoping actually, in the back of this, there's the Metta Sutta. And I suspect some of you can't read it, is that right? Because it's too dark? Yeah. It's too dark? Okay, well, just know. Especially in the Japanese Zen tradition, there's a way in which if you can't do something, you just redefine it. Anyway, maybe I'll just read it. What I wanted is for all of us to read it together as a chant. And maybe we'll do it some Monday night. Maybe we can do that as a Monday night to make up for the part of the ceremony we're missing tonight. Or perhaps it was intended. I told you the story of practicing in Japan at the Zen monastery. It was, you know, very intense Rinzai monastery. And Rinzai monasteries are known for being kind of anti-study. Anyway, these kind of just... It's a special transmission outside of words. You just practice and realize for yourself and forget the words, forget the teachings, burn the books, burn the Buddhas, burn your teachers. Which is what you have to do at some point, at least metaphorically. But, so, in this very intensive Zen monastery, they had this hour for study. And they rang the bell, and we had to get ourselves in a meditation posture on our meditation platforms. And we had our books, our sutras, and these wonderful kind of sutra covers, cloths. And you had to do a choreographed way in which you open this cloth, and you open your book, and it stands open, and you chant for a while. You chant these sutras, you have these chants for, you know, studying. So you go through all this, And as we're doing all this preparation, it's dusk and it's getting darker and darker. And then it gets darker and darker. And then it's finally a time to read. They don't turn the lights on. So we had this hour period of study with our books open in the dark. And I don't think it was unintentional. They had done their required hour of study, but they had managed to continue with their meditation practice undisturbed by such complicated words. So think of this as, think of this as something we're chanting all together. This is the work of those who are skilled and peaceful, who seek the good. May they be able and upright, straightforward, of gentle speech and not proud. May they be content and easily supported, unburdened, with their senses calmed. May they be wise, not arrogant, and without desire for the possessions of others. May they do nothing mean or that the wise would reprove. May all beings be happy. May they live in safety and joy. All living beings, whether weak or strong, tall, stout, medium or short, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be happy. Let no one deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. As a mother watches over her child, willing to risk her own life to protect her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, suffusing the whole world with unobstructed loving kindness. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, may one remain mindful of this heart and this way of living that is the best in the world. Unattached to speculations, views, and sense desires, with clear vision, such a person will never be reborn in the cycles of suffering. So now we'll do the chanting that we do for taking refuge. And I so you can take your strings, your what you call protection cord, and and one of the meanings of a refuge is it's a protection. And you can figure out for yourself what it's a protection from. And what we'll do is, as we... we'll chant the refuges in Pali, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then when we finish the refuges, chanting it all, then you can tie a single knot in this cord. And that knot will represent your intention of taking refuge. And then we'll take the precepts, and I'll chant them in Pali, best I can, and then I'll recite them in English, and then you can repeat them in English after I've said them. And then when we finish the five precepts, then you can tie another knot in the cord as a way of symbolizing that intention. So I'll start with a Namo Tassa chant, and I will chant, the full line, and then you can repeat. And I'm sorry that if you don't know it, that the lights are dim. Mm-hmm. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma
Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa.
Now I'll recite the refuge, and after I recite it, then you can repeat.
Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami.
You can tie your knot. The precepts, so I'll chant the Pali by myself and then you repeat the English.
Panatipata Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami.
For the sake of our practice, I vow to refrain from taking life.
Adinadana Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami.
For the sake of our practice, I vow to refrain from taking what is not given.
Kameso Michachara Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami.
For the sake of our practice, I vow to refrain from sexual misconduct.
Musavada Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami.
For the sake of our practice, I vow to refrain from uttering false speech.
Suramerya Majja Pamadathana Veramani Sikappadam Samadhiyami.
For the sake of our practice, I vow to refrain from taking intoxicants which lead to carelessness.
For the sake of our practice, I vow to refrain from taking intoxicants.
And then you can make the other knot. And then you can turn to someone near you and hand your cord to the other person. And that person can tie it around your neck, and then you do that for that person. And when you're finished, you can bow to each other.